Welcome to the Drive Phase Podcast, the best podcast for information on issues surrounding sports business in the Caribbean. On the Drive Phase, we have discussions with sports administrators, coaches, athletes, and various stakeholders in the sporting industry and examine their contribution to sports and entrepreneurship.
Thanks for that introduction, Colleen. Welcome to another episode of the Drive Phase Podcast. As you can tell, I am not Thousand Miles. I'm Rashika Grant, and as you may have guessed, it's time for another episode of the Producer's Corner. Today, I'll be riding solo in the host seat, and I have a very exciting episode for you, which I'm sure you will enjoy. In Play of the Day, I have an amazing group of women for the Producer's Corner with a difference, where we'll be discussing issues that women face in sport. Joining me today is Jamaican distance flag bearer Aisha Protler, media and communications specialist Marsha Boyce, sports journalist Karen Madden, and logistics manager Dr. Carol Long. Ladies, welcome and thank you for joining me as we discuss this very important issue. I'm going to start with you, Aisha. I just want you to tell me, what are some of the challenges and issues that you see female athletes face over the course of your career?
There are a lot of obstacles in the way of becoming a professional athlete as a female, starting from when you're young. It's sort of culturally expected that boys are going to play sports. And as a girl, you're not necessarily told that same thing. So I think it starts young. You see numbers of when girls start menstruation, there's so much dropout of sports. Bodies are changing. You don't know what to expect. There's not a lot of information out there as to how to sort of ride your body's changes. So you're told maybe it's not for you, maybe your body changes. And then in the sort of professional sports realm, women are paid so much less than men. They're represented so much less in the media. So you are also not seeing yourself at the highest level necessarily. You're not maybe celebrated in the way that professional male athletes are celebrated. So we even see it in a national governing body way. There are still federations in world athletics that don't send a women's team to a major championship. So it's a local and a global issue.
Dr. Long, you have worked with girls and female athletes for a very long time. Do you share the same views as Aisha?
Yes, I do. One of the things that I do notice is that the confidence of women or girls as they become adults, adolescents into womanhood, their confidence level usually dips a lot, you know, and it's because of the expectations of the cultural background. We expect women, once they start changing their shape and nobody speaks to them about it, they don't know what others are expecting, as Aisha said. And then on top of that, there is an expectation that once you start becoming a woman, sports is not your role. You're now becoming the maternal person. You're supposed to start looking to be a mother and the person in the family who's going to be taking care of others. And usually, if you're going to be involved in sports, it means that some of these areas are going to be sidelined. Well, that's the thinking. And so the confidence that girls would want to have, you know, with persons saying to them, okay, it's okay for you to go into sports, it's okay for you not to be a mother at the right time, that they don't hear that. And because of that, no, they don't want to get involved, even if they really love the sport, whatever field they're in. So that is an issue. And it's not just a Caribbean thing, I notice it's global. So it's something that we really have to think about.
It is global. Last year we did a forum on women's health, and in doing research, I realized up until age 14, adolescent girls participate in sports a lot, but there was a significant drop up to 60% in some countries. And even regionally, Carifta Games, Boys and Girls Champs, we have so many women that do well. But still, in the transition, there are still a lot of women that were so well known during that period that get lost. And so it is a global issue. What kind of measures do you think we need to put in place or recommend that are put in place to combat this specific issue, especially for adolescents, girls actually dropping out of sports really early?
That's going to be a tall ask, Rashika, because I think it has to do with, well, as Dr. Long said, it's not just a Caribbean issue, but I think if you bring it home to the Caribbean and particularly to Jamaica, it is less about measures and more about a shift in the way we view women generally and girls and the way we view sports. As both Aisha and Dr. Long have said, girls are not encouraged to participate in sports. So when you're growing up, as a little girl, you're told, come inside. You know, if it starts to get dark, most parents will be saying, come inside, while your brothers are outside kicking a ball or kicking a box. And I've said this before, that when I talk to the women on the national football team, the reggae girls, the girls who are doing better, the Bunny Shaws, the Jody Browns, those girls who are doing better at the game are the girls who were encouraged by their parents to go and play football. That's what you like, go and play it. But it's a complicated issue because on the one hand, there are parents who just want to keep their girls safe. You know, they live in a community where if the little girls are outside, they are at risk. So there's that. There is what Aisha spoke to, where the bodies of women are policed. And we see where, like, for instance, Serena Williams, for instance, has to fight that battle because her body is not, quote unquote, the traditional sexy vibe of a woman. I don't know if Aisha has it a little easier as an athlete because she's on the slender side. But I know, for instance, the women who are muscular, they have that as an issue. So there's that talk. How do you do that? And it's because, as I said, women's bodies are policed more than men. And Dr. Long spoke about it too. When girls start getting into the adolescent period and all the confusions come about, they want to look nice. They see a boy that they like. They want to look sexy for the boy. And now you're growing muscles because you're competing in sports. You're getting muscular. So they think that their sexiness is gone and that they will not be able to attract this boy that they like. So I think it's more a cultural shift more than measures that will have to fix that. But I think it's community by community, family by family, community by community, school by school. People like Dr. Long who have the influence on young girls at that age to give them the confidence to say, if this is something that you believe in, then you should do it. But as I said, across the spectrum, it's the athletes, the girls and the women who become successful are those that have parental support. There's absolutely no shortcut around that. It's the girls whose parents do not see any limits on their gender or their sex.
Thanks, Karen. You spoke about safe sports just now, and that's one of the things that the Drive Face podcast and a lot of stakeholders have been focusing on or looking to focus on. How do we make sports safer for children and girls specifically as they transition from being children to teenagers to enable them to maintain their interest in sports while they gain this new sense of self? Marsha, I'll throw this one over to you.
From where I sit, it comes down to creating that safe environment and having the supporting structures to accommodate that. So whether it is, as we talked a lot about in the previous seminars, having training and accreditation in safe sport, ensuring that persons who work with girls and children in a particular age group are trained and accredited, whether it is background checks, you know, in some jurisdictions that gets a little bit touchy, but that is also something that could come into consideration, because in creating that environment, the institution, whether it is a club, whether it is an association, a national federation, etc., it has to be a very deliberate action. It is not something that is just going to happen because, oh yeah, let's just change things. It has to be a very deliberate, documented, policy-driven action in terms of creating that safe space for girls and women to compete in.
Aisha, as a member of an athletes commission, do you think these are some of the issues that you will look to bring to the forefront and that you would love more administrations to focus on as we talk about development and sports going hand in hand?
Absolutely. So I sit on the World Athletics Athletes Commission, and as part of my role, I'm actually currently on a working group looking at human rights within World Athletics and sort of engaging with stakeholders in a way to sort of be able to guide and create a framework from which we work. How do we make decisions? How are our decisions affecting people? And something that I'm really passionate about is from an administrative level, looking at these development programs, looking at these kids programs, how can we safeguard kids? How can we make this a safe place for all athletes? And I'm really, really encouraged by a lot of work that's happening from the federation level. I think we'll see in our report and another report that's coming to World Athletics Council soon that there are sort of guiding principles that are going to be put in place that we can encourage member federations, developmental groups, and sort of trickling down with education programs and certifications and making sure that anybody who is accessible to a child knows how to handle that position with integrity and respect and understanding of the challenges that that young children are facing.
Those are some really, really good plans. I hope to see some trickle down to our region, of course.
Of course. Because
we have so much work to be done in terms of training, formal training, to help us to have a safer environment for girls, children, and women in sports. The week that we're recording in, we celebrated International Women's Day. And of course, the buzzwords, as usual, were empowerment, independence, courage, bravery. We use these words a lot, especially during this time of the year, but how can we use sport as a tool to empower our women, to make them more independent, not just our women or girls, to make them more independent and to give them the courage to take on the things that they are interested in. If it is that they no longer want to play football, but want to be an administrator or be a coach, how do we empower women to actually reach out and say, okay, I can do this too? I'll put this one to you, Dr. Long.
It's very interesting because one of the things that we have to look at first and foremost is the avenue that that particular person is coming through. You know, their background has a lot to do with the way in which they handle situations. So if we want to empower our young ones and ask them to be ambassadors later on in life, one of the things we have to do is help them from the onset. You know, a lot of them face financial challenges, and some of the reasons why they do go into sports, especially if they're going to take it to the professional level, is to combat that financial stigma that is there as it relates to them. So we have to now look at taking that stigma away, where a lot of the kids are doing it just for bare essentials, just to be able to feed themselves and help their families. So if we want them to be able to keep our children, well, to be ambassadors, as you say, we want them to be able to understand that the empowerment has to start from within. And so we have to help them to get to that point, build their self-confidence. Let them know that they are the best that they are at that point in time. And then from that platform, they can now empower others. Because if they're not going in there feeling confident about themselves, they can't change anything. It has to start with the individual. And this also now means that when we are in the schools or in clubs, there must be a role for the coach, or they must have someone in the schools or in the clubs that is assigned that role. It has to be intentional, you know, however we're planning to empower our girls so that they can move on to the next level, so that they can be ambassadors, so others can look up to them. You know, I mean, when you look at Veronica Campbell-Brown, she's a role model, you know, and I think I personally like the way in which she carries herself. And she's not one of those very flamboyant persons, but her mode of getting information out there is not all over the place because she has confidence in herself. And that is what we have to empower our young ones with. And then from that level, we can move into them empowering others so that it becomes a full cycle. I empower someone and it moves on and on. So it has to start intentionally from the minute they get into sports. And it has to be that the caretakers of these athletes must know their role, must understand the impact that they have on the women that they're working with. From the start of the early childhood age all the way up to the professional age, the persons who are in charge, whether the managers, whether the coaches, they must understand their role as impressionists. They can't just be, oh, I'm the coach, so I mean, if you have a problem, go over there. It doesn't work that way. It's a complete thing. A person that you're working with, you have to think of them holistically. It's just not about the body moving through space. It's the entire self. So we're talking about emotions. We're talking about the way in which our body shapes. We have to empower them to know that who they are, as they are the best. And it's from there that we can do the work that needs to be done.
Just wanted to jump in there. I totally agree with Dr. Long, particularly as it relates to having targeted programs for girls, especially between the ages of, let's say, 14 to 16, 14 to 18, because we focus so much on performance and not necessarily developing well-rounded athletes as it relates to confidence, as it relates to being financially literate, things like that. I'm a member of the Women and Sport Commission of the Barbados Olympic Association. So one of the programs we have is the Play Like a Girl program, which caters to that age group. You have sessions, workshop type sessions, dealing with confidence building, dealing with goal setting, dealing with understanding who you are as a person, what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are. How can you correct those weaknesses? How can you build on those strengths? And I think programs like that, tailored to a specific age group and also tailored to the peculiarities of our region, because our cultural dynamics are also important to factor in when we do these kinds of programs. And in addition to education, mentorship for me is also a very big part when it comes to empowerment. And those women, whether they be athletes or administrators or coaches or support staff who have already been there, when you see promising athletes, you know, you take them under your wing, whether it is advice, you know, sometimes people just need an ear to listen to because they might be dealing with particular challenges and they might think they're alone, not knowing, you know what, this is something that many women have gone through and here is how you can deal with it. So mentorship for me is also a big part of empowerment when it comes to women and girls in sports.
Definitely. Karen?
No, I was just adding to what Marsha and Dr. Long said, that we also need to be careful not to have this one-size-fits-all attitude, because not all girls are different. Dr. Long cited Veronica Campbell Brown, for instance. She's one way, she's one personality, but you look at, for instance, Khadija Bunny Shaw. She's a different kind of personality type. And I think it, even as we mentor our women and girls, we need to accept that everybody is different. And whereas you might have a stushy athlete, I don't know if that is Aisha, you have the rough and tumble athlete, and there's nothing wrong with that either. You understand? Right. So I think that is also important. I think a lot of administrators want to box women in this particular space, you know, because you're a girl or you're a woman, this is how you're supposed to behave, and so on. And one of the difficulties that a lot of girls have is fitting into that box. And I found it interesting also that Dr. Long said, cited the issue of some women getting involved or some girls getting involved in sports because of poverty. And I don't know that there's anything wrong with that. I don't know that there's anything wrong with that. I think about this athlete whose name, footballer whose name completely floated my head just now. She was stabbed to death a year ago.
Yes,
I still remember her name. Sorry,
she was also an Excelsiorian.
Yeah, one of the young reggae girls, right? And her drive for getting involved in sport was because she was born in abject poverty. Rothman Powell, cricketer. is male, but obviously the same principle. You're born in abject poverty, Spanish Town, St. Catherine. Same as Bonnie Shaw, Spanish Town, St. Catherine. Jody Brown, rural St. Anne. So I think that even if girls and women come from poverty, and the drive for them to compete in sports, to train until them vomit, to have the coach shouting at them, to having to wake up early, go bed late, miss out, have going to parties with them friends. If the focus for them is to come out of poverty, not having to sleep on one bed, seven or you, or pack up in one room. I personally don't see anything wrong with having that as a motivating factor. But what we need to do is to guide the process so that they know, don't cut corner. You know, we have Aisha Proudlayer, we're going to say to them, don't take drugs, you know, to cut corner because you want to achieve this goal. But I don't think it's necessary, in my opinion, to stop the drive of somebody. Them saying, oh, so the only reason why may I do this, the only reason why a coach can shout at me is because me want to move my mother out of the jungle where she living now. You know what I mean? Because a lot of our athletes, especially from the Jamaican context, a lot of our athletes have come from poverty, and they have used that as a huge driving force.
Which is what I was getting at, Karen, that irrespective of what your motive is or your motivation is, it should not be that one factor that identifies you, because you are not just that. You are more than that. And so if I want to use poverty and say in the back of my mind, I'm getting out of it and sports is my role and the road that I'm going to choose, it should not be a defining factor. What it means is that I'm going to make sure that this particular athlete knows that irrespective of what your background is, you are still a human being and you want to achieve the best, and here's how we can do it. We need to motivate them in the right and proper way, so that when we are empowering them, they know that here's the right route. And that is why I agree with Marsha. Mentorship is extremely important, which is one of the things I do. When I'm involved in teams, that is my role. I am the mentor. They come to me. They sit and talk with me. And it is very important because some of them don't have the listening ear.
That's very true, Dr.
So they need that power to know that there's someone that they can go to and can help them to move to the next level. So these are some of the things that we have to think about.
Definitely. By the way, the senior moment that I got a while ago, Rashika, the name of the reggae girl I was trying to remember was Tarania Clark. Tarania Plum Plum Clark.
Yes, that's
from
right.
From Nannyville in St. Andrews.
I just wanted to add a quick moment. I think it was really important what was said, that we shouldn't expect female athletes to be in one box and to be one size fits all. This is how you carry yourself. This is how you act, because we don't expect men to do that. And I think that there's so much pressure. I feel pressure to hold myself in a certain way, you know, to not be intimidating, to not speak up too much. But we don't expect these things from male athletes. So why should we expect them from female athletes? So I'm really glad that you brought that to the conversation.
Those are some really, really excellent points, ladies. I want to shift the needle a bit now to speak about the pandemic, and how do you think the pandemic has affected female sports, its visibility, and also its development? And what do you think may be the long-term effects of it on female athletes and female-dominated sports? Aisha, I'll start with you.
Sure. Earlier, I mentioned that a big roadblock for female sport is funding. And in the pandemic, funding from all levels in all places and all things has dried up. And female sport is 10th on the list of anything to do with sport. We're not going to get the funding first. Let's be real here. It's not going to happen. So I think that we'll see some years to have to rebuild and pick up where we left off of what support have we gotten from our clubs? Have we been able to train in places? What's that going to look like for the development of each athlete that's practicing now and also the next generation of athletes? So I hope to see in the future, when, you know, in the next few months, hopefully, restrictions are lifted because people are healthier and we're in a different situation. But I really worry about it. I really worry about these programs that maybe they're not going to thrive in the way that they did before.
I was in a forum and they were saying that in last year when the discussion regarding the restart of sports came up, there was a rush to put out male football, etc., male cricket, but netball still faced a lot of roadblocks, etc. And a lot of that has to do with sponsorship and funding. How important is it now, even more now than ever, that we get into the boardrooms, that we get into the discussion, the decision-making table, to ensure that even if there's no one there that thinks about the female sport, that we have someone there to say, okay, yes, we want reggae boys to be back out playing international football, but what about the reggae girls? What are the steps that we as women need to take to ensure that we have a place at the table, that diversity in the decision makers will make diverse decisions? I'll go with you, Marshall.
So if it's one thing that the pandemic really showed us, was that disparity between male and female sport. You know, as you mentioned, there was a rush to get certain sports restarted. And in some cases, particularly in European women's football, it was, okay, let's just end the competition with no attempt to even restart. And it is unfortunate. And in terms of sponsorship for me and looking forward to the future, that is where the hardest part will be, because it felt as if female sport was on the rise, particularly women's football was really gaining momentum coming out of the Women's World Cup. International women's cricket was really, you know, getting the viewership, getting the eyes. At least the numbers were increasing, and bam, the pandemic strikes and everything is halted and the push is to get male sport resumed. I think from female sport administrators or those with the responsibility for administrating women's sport, the onus will be on becoming innovative and creative and how you can attract that sponsorship dollar. The recent statistics show that the fan base for sport across the board is getting closer to 50-50, 50% male, 50% female. So with that in mind, here's the perfect opportunity now for associations and organizations to target that female fan base through female sport. And it is an opportunity, you know, for businesses looking to recover from the market share they themselves would have lost as a result of the pandemic. So, you know, tap into what is largely an untapped market, because you find a lot of the marketing, a lot of the planning is geared toward the stereotypical male fan. So now as we move forward, what can we do to tap into that untapped female fan market? That will be important for administrators, event holders, and so forth to consider.
It's a catch-22 though, you know, Marsha, because you're entirely right. The pandemic certainly levels the playing field, because even the sports that are coming back are going to be coming back without fans, right? So the playing field is level, whereas men's sport, of course, usually have the lion's share of the fans, and as a result, the lion's share of the sponsorship dollar. So now that the playing field is quote-unquote level, because now the sports are coming back, but they are coming back without fans, so everybody has to turn to TV. But I think it's agitation, though, that Rashika, that's going to fix that. I think that the athletes and the administrating arms, the federations and whatnot, they are going to have to be pushing more for the sponsorship dollar to be split so that the women are getting the kind of support. You're entirely right. What is happening now is that the conversation is about bringing back sport. And what I really mean is bringing back men's sport. And so the sport for women is just tacked on, you know. Aisha is a little bit luckier because the Olympics is the Olympics. And that's men and women. Track and field is a lot luckier than other sports because, of course, women have done so well, and in Jamaica, actually, it's the women who are doing a lot better than the men, especially in the post-Usain Bolt era. But I think Marsha is right that what the pandemic has done, as much as the harm that has happened as a result, it has actually leveled the playing field in terms of going after the fans, going after the sponsorship dollar, but it's going to take agitation. It's not going to just happen. You know, people is not going to just look around and say, oh, we should sponsor the reggae girls. Oh, we should sponsor the Women's Premier League. there has to be agitation. So, and it's obviously people like me in the media that will need to do that, but we can't just do it out in and of ourselves. You know, it's going to be taking the athletes themselves who are going to be calling out the federations to ensure that women's sport is not just left behind.
I think just to add to that, I agree with you where, you know, it's a double-edged sword and you see it play out at different ends of that sword. On the professional or commercial realm, when you look at the WNBA really benefited, so to speak, from the visibility as a result of the pandemic, because now you had more games on television because there was content to fill. There was airtime that needed to be filled. And coming out of that, their signature orange hoodie became one of the best-selling sports products in the U.S. across the board, with competing with male and female, you know, across sporting disciplines, just from that visibility. For us in the Caribbean, I think one of the challenges will be at that amateur sport level and that grassroots sports level, where there's already that disparity, where the Women's League for football or the Women's League for basketball is already seen as that outside step child, so to speak. So now there's even less money to go around. How do we keep these players engaged? That will definitely be a challenge going forward.
The issue of athletes agitating, do we find that women are less open to discussing the issues in terms of disparity, in terms of pay, etc.? And how do we get that to stop being an open secret, especially regionally? In America, we saw where the American footballers really put forward the argument and they did not back down. But how do we get our female athletes regionally, whether it's as footballers, cricketers, etc., how do we get them to consistently have that conversation on the table?
The thing with the U.S. women's football team is that they were the number one. They're FIFA defending champion, multiple four-time winners of the World Cup. So they were actually the biggest sport than the men's game. So they had that as a push. But I don't know, people like Dr. Long can explain to me why, and Aisha, and can explain to me why athletes, Jamaican women athletes, do not agitate for anything at all. And I mean, like the Shelley and Fraser Prices of this life, they don't agitate for nothing. I mean, recently we saw when she came out and she was talking about the return of track and field, and I think that was not because your pockets start hurt you now. You know, kind of thing. And that was good, obviously. That was good, right? Shelley's rich, and her coming out and saying that, you know, sport needs to return, obviously is going to redound to the benefit of other athletes who are not as rich as she is. But on the other hand, I as a journalist, have a real problem, I have to tell you, Aisha, with Jamaican athletes, because they don't agitate. They don't make up noise or anything. For instance, look at the issue when Nike wanted to cut women cut their money when they came back from maternity leave, right? And at the time, and still is, Shelley is a Nike athlete, but it took the Americans to take Nike to task to say, no, you cannot do this. We are the child bearers. We know I'm no. There's nothing that we can do. We bear the children. Women bear the children, right? While the men can continue with their careers. But it took the Americans to do the agitation for women to not lose their sponsorship, any type of sponsorship, when they go on maternity leave. So that for me is a huge issue, and I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Aisha is an athlete, does, or Dr. Long, with her training does, but I don't know how you fix that.
All right. I think for us, Karen, it's cultural, very cultural. It is an embedded thing where women were once to be like children, seen and not heard. Your role was very docile, and it continued for decades, centuries, not even decades, centuries, where the Caribbean women, they were seen as persons who were just to carry load, you know, whether it's childbearing or in the kitchen or the million and one children that they had that they looked after, and they were the maternal ones, and they were not to speak out. And the minute that you start speaking out, you are sidelined, because I think part of the issue is that the male ego can't manage a very strong woman. because they are, especially in the Caribbean, because they don't like to feel that the women have the upper hand. It's a cultural thing. It is coming from our history. It's not just something that was picked up. We inherited it. It's in our DNA. And so it's a change of thinking that has to happen. If you think about if you were in high school, let's say you're at high school and something happened and you spoke up, the first thing they're going to do is tell you to be quiet. The boys can go ahead and make their claims. Girls were always told to be quiet. Or if you were talking loudly, you were rude and you were not ladylike. And so anything that is going to cause any form of agitation, they think that women are not supposed to be involved in it. And so when you have someone like probably Amava Bernard who will talk out, or if you knew when we were starting out Girls Champs, Joyce Taylor was a woman who was president of the Girls Ministries Association for a long time. I mean, I'm sure most of you don't know Joyce Taylor, never heard of her, or probably just know a little of her. But she was one of those ladies that spoke out and people didn't like her. And she's not a very big person. She's not like a Leela Robinson, strong bodied, big bodied. Joyce was very small, but she spoke out a lot. She was the one that she, along with other members of the Gamesmen's Association, founded Jamaica Physical Education Association. And we marched to the ministry because every other department that had a physical section to it, a practical area to it, they were getting what they called, I forget that name, the name that they had it, caution money, where they allowed you. So if you were working in the lab, you got money to buy lab coats and all that. So if you were teaching physics and all that, physical education teachers were given nothing, basic pay. And that was it. And Joyce decided this cannot work. And the members of the Gamesmen's Association said, it cannot work. This is ridiculous. You asking PE teachers to go out there, they have to change their clothes, but you're not giving them extra funds to do that. And they went to the Ministry of Education and they sat there and they would not move until they were given an audience. Of course, Joyce was put down as a monster, so to speak, because she spoke out. And these are things that we have to change the mindset, that not because you are speaking out for something that it's your right to something and you're speaking out for it, that you are an ogre. That's not it. And that is what happens to women when they speak out. And so what needs to happen is the change of an ideology. It's a paradigm shift. It's how we think about women and how they must sound. We must have a certain sound. We're not supposed to, and we have to have a certain look, you know? And the minute we don't, as Karen and Aisha and Marsha, all of us say, if you don't fit that mold, then something is wrong with you. And this is something that we have to think about. How are we going to change that mold? And in changing the mold, then we can say, all right, women can speak out. You know, when it's like saying, okay, when the girls started football, or when they do skeleton in the bobsleigh, you know, women, it's not because they're muscular that they must be changed, they must be thought of differently. No, women have the right to do the things that their bodies can tell them to do, and they also have the right for everything else that is for them. And as it pertains to not speaking out, Karen, I think the thing is that some of them are afraid of what society sees them as, you know, and they're going to be sidelined, and so they may not get the sponsorship that they need, because the sponsors fear that they're going to become boisterous out there and take away their role as that nice, petite, lovely.
But Dr. Long, I'm not talking about emerging athletes, though, you know. I'm not talking about emerging athletes, and I'm talking about athletes who are at the top of their game, who have the voice. Those are the athletes I'm talking. I'm not expecting a young emerging athlete to agitate. Sorry?
It's a mindset. It's a mindset. It's how we see things. It's how we were initiated into this thing of sports. You know, you want to get ahead? Be quiet. Let the coach tell you what to do and you just do it. I mean, I taught at a high school for 17 years where I helped with coaching. And most of these girls were quiet when the coach spoke to them in unthinkable ways. I had to stand up for them.
But those are girls in school. Those are girls in school.
Yeah, but when they went to college,
right,
the same thing happened to them. And so it's inbred. You know, it's something that it's a cultural thing that has been infused in us. And so in order for us now to start speaking out, we have to change how we see and how we hear ourselves as women. And this is something that we now have to teach to the younger generation. So when someone, you know, I mean, when Shellyann wrote that article, you see how many persons read it? Because it was something like, whoa, she really talking out. She really means something. You know, it wasn't. And
that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying, Dr. Long. But that's my point, Dr. Long. I'm saying that when an athlete of the stature of a Shellyann Fraser-Pryce speaks, she brings with her significant platform. That's why the Black Lives Matter have the big athletes on them. They James and all those top athletes, because you bring the significance of your platform. I would love to hear Aisha on this though, because I mean she's an athlete, and I totally get what you're saying, you know, Dr. Long. I know that it's a cultural issue, but I'm saying that once you are no longer under the thumb of somebody, I think that should free you to speak. But what do I know? Aisha.
I agree with what you both are saying. I think Dr. Long makes a really important point that, it's sort of the nature to not speak up. But I think if I could speak personally, I'm the primary breadwinner for our family. And if you become a quote unquote problem child for your sponsor, other sponsors aren't going to look to you. And I feel personally that we're not quite at the level that female sports should be. I don't feel comfortable necessarily to speak out on all of the things that I have loud opinions to a small group of people. And it puts you in a very vulnerable position when you start speaking out. I hate that I do this, but when I see a female athlete make a statement, and what do? I click on the comments. And those comments can be vitriol. They can be totally horrible things and sort of poking the bear to say, you're lucky to be here as a female athlete. You're lucky that you get to be a female athlete because X, Y, and Z, you don't belong. And that's a really delicate place to put yourself when, you know, we thrive on confidence. We win medals on confidence. We perform on confidence. And if you are struck down peg by peg by speaking up, it can leave you in a very vulnerable situation, mentally, emotionally, and also financially. If sponsors start to think, she's a bit of a risk, you might see your bottom line decreasing.
Aisha, you've spoke about the impact, the negative impact that it can have if you speak out. But what role and what way do you see yourself contributing to girls and young women that are in sports after you have left sports to be more empowered, to be able to speak? What are some of the things that you think we can do now to make it easier for them in the future to speak about the things that affect them?
I think we are in sort of a great wave right now of the tide is changing for female athletes. I think one of the largest things I can do, which Marcia brought up earlier, is mentorship. And I was able to sort of start this line before COVID hit of trying to get some grassroots mentorship with some high schools in Jamaica. But it's going to take, I think, three things. One, for as Karen says, athletes at the top to come out, speak out, show that you can. And the negative repercussions are smaller than you think. I think that's important. The second thing is I take this responsibility working on the World Athletics Federation level of pushing female gender parity, having, you know, 50-50% in a leadership role, of having women in the rooms where decisions are being made. And then third, I do think that it's going to be reaching out on a small scale and having those sort of mentorship situations in place where we can sort of bridge the gap. Top athletes are just people, you know, I'm just a person like everyone else. And I think if we can sort of close that gap of what we think that the professional sports world is and a young girl starting at her club, I think we'll see more confident, stronger female voices in sport in the future.
I think in addition to the vulnerability that Aisha mentioned, that notion of having the decision makers or more female decision makers in the boardroom is important, because sometimes, you know, you hear from athletes, for those who might be bold enough, sometimes for them, it is a sense of futility. It doesn't make sense me saying anything because nobody's listening to me. Nothing is going to change. So you still need that. You can keep noise from now to tomorrow, but if those in the decision-making positions do not identify with you, if they don't see what your problem is as important, then nothing will still change. So it has to be twofold. Yes, we need the athletes to speak out and to represent and be the advocates for their own causes, but we also need those in decision-making positions to see athletes as important, because sometimes there's that disconnect between athletes and administrators. So feeling heard is also very important. And if you have that sense of futility, then you'll find that less people would speak out for things because they feel as if, you know what, it wouldn't make any difference.
I also think that role models are very important in this aspect as well. So if you have strong athletes that are speaking out and that they can show the younger ones coming up what it means to be a strong female athlete, whether we are administrator. So we need to have strong role models out there as well. So whether they're administrator or coach or an athlete, we need to find those athletes that we can say, okay, here's a good role model. And we can try and pull them in, bring them. I mean, Aisha is trying to start something with a mentorship program. Find leaders that we can say, here are the ones that we can look to and have these girls, you know, look up and say, all right, I may not necessarily agree with everything that person says, but I can see where the road ends. You know, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. We can get there, but we need someone. We can't just be speaking. We need role models as well. So with the mentorship program, I have to find good role models to put in place for the athletes to be able to find a way to achieve, you know. So that is one of the other things that can be done.
That's very true. A big part of empowering women is also for men that are already in these positions to see the value of diversity. How important is it that we have more men, especially regionally, reaching out to include more women that have an interest in sports administration, in coaching, in actually competing? How important is it to have male advocates to advance the opportunities for women in sports? Karen, I'll take this one to you because you are in a male-dominated field also, and so I want to hear your views.
Well, I think it just takes one person to believe, I think, and I've said this before, that one Patrick Anderson believed, you know, and here I am. So I think that is what is required, you know, one man to believe. I know, for instance, at MVP Track Club here in Jamaica, Stephen Francis believes he has women as coaches on his staff. So I think that is what is required, you know, that as the men, as the top coaches in the business, if we're looking at coaching, the Stephen Francis's, Glenn Mills, Maurice Wilson, the top coaches of clubs, of elite athletes here, if they understand that it is important that the knowledge is also shared with women. And I don't want women to become coaches just because you want a woman as a coach.
Yep.
It has to be someone who has the skill set.
Qualified.
For the job, right? You're not going to just get a job because you're a woman and we need a woman on the staff, you know? So it has to be someone who's interested. For instance, I know, for instance, at MVP, Bridget Foster Hilton, who used to be an athlete, she's now a coach on the staff because Frana believed and she had the ability and so on. As it relates to the federations and the associations, it also requires men who believe, and I think women who show themselves as worthy of that. You know, I'm happy to see that Aisha is on the Athletes Commission, and I think that affords her a stepping stone in terms of propelling herself into administration, if that is what she wants to do. But that opens the door. And I think when Dr. Long speaks a lot about mentoring and so on, I think we also need to tell young ladies and girls that even if you do not make it as an athlete, because obviously not everybody is going to be an Olympian, not everybody is going to be Commonwealth champion like Aisha and so on, but there are other areas you can look to. You can become a coach, you can become an administrator, you can become a referee, you know, you can teach, you know. So I think those are some of the advice that I would say that needs to be sent down to all women and girls.
Can I just add one thing as well? We also need to ensure that our girls know that the non-traditional areas that are basically just men, that it's open to them. Because a lot of times they don't believe it is. And so we have to push that as well. You know, a physiotherapist, a sports psychologist, things like that. It's open for them. It's not a male-dominated field anymore. And so we have to push that when we're talking to the younger generation coming up. And even if we didn't go into the field, we can give them avenues in which to move into the area as well.
Just to add something quickly to that, for me, the support of males or male champions in this fight is absolutely crucial, to the point where I honestly believe we can't reach that level of gender equity in sport without male support. If we accept that sport right now is male dominated and the administrative positions and the research shows that they're dominated by males, then the only way you can get in technically is if you are let in by said males. It might be difficult to hear it that way, but that is the reality. So we definitely need that male support, those male champions, whether it is, and not only the male support, but visible support, opening pathways, opening doors. If there's one woman on your executive committee, ensuring that her voice is heard during meetings and not she's just not there because you have to tick that box to have a female representative on your committee. So you need that visible support, you know, that opening of pathways and creating pathways for women to come through. One of the advocates for that in the Caribbean, we've had him on the podcast as a guest, Brian Lewis, the TTOC president, and his mantra is the future is female. And we need more males to buy into that thinking. You know what? The world is changing. Let us develop and build capacity within our female body to get more female leaders in our organizations.
Thank you so much for that point, Marsha. I just want to close. I just want to ask Aisha, what are the opportunities, even based on our own discussions today, that you believe that's important for us to capitalize in the, especially in the short term and also in the long term, if you want to say?
That's a great question. I'm really inspired by what Dr. Long just said of encouraging women. You know, we're not all going to land at the top, but thinking about different pathways to be involved in sport. And I think that the whole culmination of this conversation is we need men to stand by us, alongside us vocally. We need to have female athletes in the media vocally saying that we need to push things forward. And we need people like Karen to tell our stories and to elevate this all to be what it can become. Female athletes are amazing. We have great stories. We have a place in sport. And with everybody pulling together, the way forward is going to be amazing.
Thank you so much for that, Aisha. And on that note, I want to thank all of you ladies for being a stellar cast today as we discuss this very important issue I hope that we can continue to push the conversation of women and girls in sports having a safer environment and also having more opportunities to grow within sports outside of what we are used to having them for. So thank you so much again for taking the time out to be on the Drive Phase podcast.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
It was a pleasure, Rashika. Thank you. Thank you, ladies. It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thanks, everyone.
On behalf of the production team, thank you for joining us on another episode of the Drive Faves podcast. Let us know what you think about the episode. You can leave a feedback on our Apple Podcast or on our YouTube channel. Please also remember to subscribe to our channel and click the notification bell so you never miss an episode. Check out our website where you can access all our episodes and also other ventures that we have done. Make sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, or Stitcher so you never miss an episode. Remember, we'd also appreciate a rating on iTunes or any podcast platform that you use. Tell a friend about the show so they too can spread the word. Remember to send us feedback, comments, or look us up on Facebook and Twitter at The Drive Phase or TVP. Until next time.